It's Jeremy.
Thank you, Ken, very much indeed. This music will bring back some memories, I bet. Today, our tribute to Sir Jimmy Young, who founded this show. He had the idea of mixing music and politics and letting the audience know they were just as important as the people who governed them. We're going to have some tributes, personal tributes, paid by many of his old friends. We'll also discuss what effect will Trump or Clinton's policies have on Britain. Is it possible to say one candidate is better for us than another? And a mum is told her son will never walk. She refuses to accept the advice and never picks him up when he falls. He is now one of the UK's leading entrepreneurs. We meet him. Bet you've got memories of Jimmy if you'd like to share them. 0500-288-291. Did you call him on that number? Did your comment get read out by the great man? Email vine@bbc.co.uk. But we'll go to the newsroom first and hear the very latest BBC News from Jane Royce.
Thanks, Jeremy. Prince Harry has accused the media of crossing a line with recent coverage about his girlfriend, the American actress Meghan Markle. BBC News at 12:03. Our next at 1.
Thank you very much, Jane. Jeremy, welcome to the show. Why don't we start with a song by the man who started the show?
Oh, my love, my darling, to me.
Jimmy Young, who started, of course, as a singer of ballads. By his own account, his singing career ran into trouble because of Elvis. That was basically it. He went on the radio and that was a gift for us all. We're going to look at a bit of the history of Jimmy Young, about what he did to create this show. We'll speak as well to one of his key controllers, Jim Moyer, who ran Radio 2 for a long time. But first, our producer, Tim Johns, looks back at Sir Jimmy Young's life and the huge impact he made on this radio station.
Radio 2, Jimmy Young.
Morning all, thanks to Bill Murray for Open House and a warm welcome to the JY Show. In today's programme, we'll be finding out why innocent people are being convicted.
Morning all, and WWW. Very warm Wednesday welcomes all round, you see. Let's kick off this morning with the Archers, and we will have a tiny touch of what this
sugar. The JY prog ran on Radio 2 from 1973 to 2002. But for someone who spent so much of his life on air, Jimmy came to broadcasting relatively late. Jimmy Young had Forest of Dean roots, and he loved music and sport from an early age. He worked as a baker's boy and later as an electrician before signing up to the RAF. He spent years in India and Burma. But in the 1950s, his career turned towards music.
They try to tell us we're too young.
Following record deals and chart success, his singing career faltered as the era of rock and roll came to challenge the crooner generation. And so, to the radio. Following a spell with Radio Luxembourg, he was signed as part of the opening lineup for Radio 1, despite being 46 years old.
The time is 10 o'clock. You're listening to Radio 1.
Yes, Jimmy proved to be a hit, but it wasn't until his move in 1973 to Radio 2 that he finally found his natural home.
This is Radio 2. Jimmy Young.
The JY prog discussed lifestyle, legal advice, health.
Here we have Dr. Michael Smith. How are you doing today, Gosh?
I'm well, sir, thank you. Yes.
There was gardening.
Back we go to Daffers and to Charles, who's just phoned us some Worthing. He said, I hate gardening.
And there was always a recipe. But the JY prog was remarkable for a couple of reasons. First, Jimmy forever blurred the lines between news and entertainment. Here's Ken Bruce.
Before Jim came along, the two were very, very separate. The news and current affairs were very serious matters. And when Jim got this idea of interviewing politicians and people who were making the news, he ruffled quite a few feathers.
Politics became a mainstay of the show.
And in the studio with me is the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable John Major. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning, Jim.
Jimmy interviewed every British Prime Minister from Sir Alec Douglas Hume onwards.
The surveys say that the people who are most likely to benefit for are people who are on good incomes living in expensive houses.
Well, the people who are most likely to benefit are those widows and pensioners who are single now, living in their own house.
That yours is a government that's lost its way, and it's lost the advantages of the large majority and a strong economy.
Well, you know, you obviously get criticisms as a government, but let me try and put
you... But that's a hell of a lot of criticism.
Political interviews became the hallmark of his career. Some politicians made the mistake of thinking he was a soft touch.
I get accused in the press sometimes of being too kind to people, you see, although the fact is that I believe that you can ask unkind questions with a smile on your face.
A soft touch, he was anything but. As he would say, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher knew this well.
He knew his stuff, but he also knew when the person he was interviewing knew their stuff. And so you got a very much better interview. He wasn't trying to trip you up. He was trying to bring the best out of you. But if you didn't know your stuff, that would be revealed.
He's a lot tougher than anyone told me to expect. And if he had you pinned, you would stay pinned.
There was a second thing which made the JY prog groundbreaking.
There is an enormous amount of reaction from you.
One day, a listener got through the BBC switchboard to the production team. A producer wrote down the listener's comment. The comment reached the hands of Jimmy Young and he read it on air. Listeners' comments came to be at the heart of the programme.
Which brings me to the first question from John Needham from Coventry, who says, if it's a good idea to encourage people to switch from their cars to public transport, why does the Deputy Prime Minister still run two Jags, and doesn't he agree he'd set a very good example if he announced now that he was giving up at least one of them?
Well, one is my own. I've only got one car, that's the one, and it's 8 years old and it's a Jaguar.
Long before the radio phone-in, long before audience interaction became the norm in broadcasting, Jimmy Young was doing it. This to Tony Benn is from 1975.
I'll start with one which comes from Mrs. Dean, who lives at Sidmouth in Devon, lives at Primley Mead. And she says, could someone please tell me what advantages would accrue if the United Kingdom were to come out of the common market?
Well, from a trade point of view...
For decades, Sir Jimmy Young was a friend to millions. But more than that, with the political interviews and an interactive programme, he truly broke the mould. He made news accessible and intimate for millions of people in this country like no one ever had.
That's it for today. Anyway, have a lovely super afternoon.
And take care of yourselves. On behalf of JYBFN, bye for now.
Very proud to have been Sir Jimmy's successor. And we speak to another Jim now, Jim Moyer, former controller of Radio 2, former head of light entertainment at the BBC. You were essentially Jimmy Young's boss, so you can remember him well.
I do remember him well. We worked alongside each other for 8 years. And Jeremy, it's a great privilege to add my voice to the great chorus of tributes to Sir Jimmy and to acknowledge his contribution to popular broadcasting, and to do so, Jeremy, here in the same broadcasting space that he occupied for over three decades with such incredible success. So, Jeremy, thank you for that. It was Jimmy, as Ken Bruce observed, who conjoined the world of music and entertainment with the world of current affairs and politics. Strange bedfellows when he started, but over time, this mixture was to characterise the show and to give Radio 2 distinctiveness and a raised profile and stature in the broadcasting landscape. In many ways, the format and content of his show displayed the classic Reithian values. He entertained, he informed, and along the way, he educated. And Radio 2 listeners will recall his easy, affable, but fact-filled conversations with Tony DeAngeli from the Grocer magazine, do you recall that? Mm-hmm. The Legal Beagle, Bill Thomas, and the Legal Eagle, Andrew Phillips, and Matters Medical were discussed with Dr. Mike Smith. These interviews, coupled alongside Jimmy's warmth and good humour, were the staples of this fast-moving mixture, and all this achieved with great broadcasting skill and high intelligence. And as you well know, Jeremy, it's well known that he has interviewed every British Prime Minister since Harold Macmillan, and no general election or budget passed without the scrutiny of Sir Jimmy. To this extent, He had a rare personal skill, which he honed with meticulous preparation. He was, I think the world would agree, a superb interviewer and a shrewd commentator.
There's a story, Jim, that the whole idea of the audience interacting happened by accident in the early 70s. He was interviewing Edward Heath. Somebody got through to the production office with a complaint about Heath. A producer wrote it out on a piece of paper, took it through to Jimmy. He read it to Edward Heath, and in that moment, radio, TV, interactive programmes were born.
Absolutely, and he continued using listeners' contributions and comments in his show. And, of course, the modern-day equivalent of that is the phone-in. And, yes, Jimmy was at the forefront of that innovation. He will be remembered, too, for his duelling wit with another sadly departed broadcasting legend, Sir Terry Wogan. Their morning exchanges of friendly barbs were entertainment of a very, very high order. Mm. You see, he had a fast mind and quickly transferred his wit to his tongue, which made him both entertaining and, when required, a probing interviewer. In a world where current affairs was peopled by heavy hitters, Jimmy's approach of courtesy, the use of first names, created an engaging atmosphere for participants and listeners alike. So the Jimmy Young Show, the JY Prog, was, I venture to say, a great example of what is meant by public service broadcasting and the pursuit of excellence. And above all, his knighthood was so richly deserved.
Now, he wouldn't forgive me if I didn't ask about his exit from the station. At some point, the BBC decided that an 82-year-old couldn't present this show anymore, and you had to deal with that.
Yes, it fell to me. It was a very hard and difficult decision to communicate to a man who I admired so greatly, but Radio 2 at that time was continuing to evolve. Music and musical styles were changing, and Radio 2, in the view of the BBC, had to find a secure place in the broadcasting future. So with Jimmy having achieved some 82 years, it was difficult to plan ahead with a five-year strategy. So his long and distinguished run had to come to an honourable finish and allow him to go out at the very top of his game.
It is a very, very sad time for us at Radio 2, isn't it? Because you mentioned we lost Terry this year as well. We're losing some real legends of radio.
It has to be said that the reception area of heaven is extremely busy with the necessity to find the billing and dressing rooms for the great stars who have gone to their celestial end. Mm. We've lost so many this year. It's deeply sad.
And reflecting on Jimmy, 29 years in this chair, do you think part of it is actually, I mean, it's a boring quality in a way, but it's stamina and longevity, and you keep coming in?
Absolutely. And all this under the umbrella of his meticulous preparation. He absolutely loved it. It was in his bones. He worked very hard on it, and that's why he was so good at it.
Thank you very much indeed. Jim Moyer, former controller of Radio 2. Andrew Phillips, the so-called legal eagle. And I've got that right, Andrew, because there was a legal beagle, but you were the legal eagle.
I'm the one up in the sky.
So, well, Mike, first of all, you answered questions on the show for many years.
I did indeed. I'm nearly 30, because when I started, I was a spokesperson for a national organisation, and that's how I got associated with Jim. And we had many things in common. I mean, I read his one-page ad obituary in one of the papers this morning saying he was a miner's son. He always told me he's a baker's son like I was, and we both left school at 15, and there we are, and here we are now. And I mean, he told it like it was, which is one of the reasons why the politicians trusted him. You know, they didn't mind coming on his show because he wasn't going to ask some tricky questions. Although he did. I mean, deep down there amongst the honey, there was the tricky questions.
Sure, but he didn't try and blindside them as became the fashion.
That's right. It became the passion turns on, dare I say it, the posher programmes. I mean, Jim, Jim kept
that.
It. Jim talked to everybody in a way that they could understand.
Yeah. And well, let's stick on the interviewing for a moment, Lord Andrew Phillips, because you obviously come out of the political world as well.
Do you mind not calling me Lord?
Oh, Lord, sorry, I won't call you Lord. This comes up.
Anyhow, I've resigned.
This comes up every time, I know. He used to call you Lord, by the way.
I know he did, a rotten old turn, so he knew I didn't like it.
He used to call it. I'm doing the same thing. So we had Robin Day and we had Paxman, and that was the whole news environment. But this was different, this studio, wasn't it, for interviews?
Yes, it was. And he had, I think you've said it, Jim, he had a natural empathy with so-called ordinary people. He was completely uneducated, Jim, but he was highly naturally intelligent. And he had this wondrous gift of managing to encapsulate the most complicated ideas in straightforward English. Mm. And as I say, his empathy with Mr. and Mrs. Average was a huge benefit.
We don't think of anybody like that anymore. Maybe he was ahead of his time.
Well, I think in ways he was. And the thing that I particularly liked about him, from my legal vantage point, I mean, the law was becoming grotesquely complicated back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Today, it is lunatic. Half of the reason why people voted Brexit is they don't understand where the hell they are with their own democracy, let alone a European one. And he understood that.
Yeah. What was the classic? Well, I'll ask you first, Mike. The classic question that a listener rang up with, the health question that you and Jimmy helped to answer. Give us what was in the air.
Well, what was in the air at the time was that doctors were still talking in Latin and Greek, largely. I mean, not precisely, but they were, and therefore they weren't telling it like it was. For instance, you know, the tender underparts, which Terry Wogan always said I was the doctor of the tender underparts, were still talked about as, dare I say, the front passage. Now, Jim changed all that and started saying, talking in ways that everybody thought, well, I can understand that. Hopefully that's what I did with medicine, because it was still, I mean, because I did medicine a little later, as I say, I left my grammar school at 15. I used to say in a very polite way to the big bosses in the hospitals, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't do classics. I don't understand that. And a few of them couldn't explain it in everyday English. And I thought, whoopee, here's a slot, you know. And that Jim found that same slot when discussing things like the law, politics, with prime ministers, albeit. So he actually talked through in a way that people could understand.
And legal questions, what came up, Andrew?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I never forget it, really building on what Jim's just said. I had a very early phone-in question, because they were the ones you were rather frightened of. And it was a professor of law, whose name I don't remember, saying, hasn't Mr. Phillips heard of the maxim? And then he came out with some bloody great lengthy Latin maxim. And of course, I hadn't heard of the damn thing. And I said, no, I haven't heard of it, but I don't think it'll make the slightest difference to my answer, Jim. And he did laugh.
were you doing garden fence disputes? What kind of everything. Legal questions were coming up?
Everything. And the team who dealt with these hundreds and thousands of questions written in under John Garnett and co, brilliant team, I'm sure they are now under Phil Jones. And they passed through to me sort of 15 to 20 questions a week, a fortnight it was, and they had selected them brilliantly so that they were often very typical of, as you say, neighbour disputes and that sort of thing, but occasionally totally untypical. So you get the sort of run-of-the-mill questions laced with the most improbable disputes and situations, which gave a great life and variety to the thing.
But, Mike, did callers ring up in those days, or was it all read-off letters?
No, it was all read-off. It wasn't a phone-in, although I think people would phone in, but the producer and the staff...
Would take it down,
and then subsequently. And also, we ended up for the last five... I did it for nearly 30 years, because, as I say, I started as spokesman for a national organisation... And Jim and I became
chums. You keep not mentioning which this organisation is. Is it a secret?
Planning Association.
Oh, I see, OK.
And I was the chief medical officer responsible for the 1,000 clinics, the family planning clinic, before the NHS took over.
But why didn't you have phone-ins?
Well...
You didn't have them either, did you?
Yes,
you had people ring up?
Absolutely. During a programme, saying, Andrew Phillips just said this, but, you know, I went to my solicitor last week and he said that.
Yes, okay. But Jim would read that out. It wasn't directly. I mean, I did phone-ins for another station, which we won't mention, but
well,
I did phone-ins.
We can, because they're very... with Anna Rayburn, they were so famous. What Capital you're talking about?
No, I did a bit of Capital, but I did LBC every week in the evening for an hour, and people would then phone me from London, you know, Londoners.
But this was still... In a funny way, I always think that the thing of having the comments was absolutely groundbreaking.
Oh, yes.
But Jimmy didn't then move to the stage of having callers. He kept it at comments. And then, strangely, the world caught up because we had email and text and everyone starts reading comments off bits of paper again. So he was cutting edge again. So yes. Right to the very end, Andrew, it was a must-listen, was it?
Yes, in a funny way. I mean, it's extraordinary the breadth of audience he had. It seemed to appeal to... right across the social board.
Yep. You felt, Andrew, that because of his background, because of his childhood, there was an interesting quality he had.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, poor old Jim had about as unprivileged a background as you can imagine. Brought up by a single mother in near poverty in the Forest of Dean, and he had a very hard life. He left school as soon as he could. He got his way into the RAF, I think, by fabricating his age. He was actually not old enough to get in. I think he told me that. And he had a very tough background, and that told, I think, in his personality. He was actually extremely quiet about his own likes, dislikes and personality. And he was found it very difficult to make friends.
He's quite a wounded person.
He was. And I remember first New Year's Eve, we had a programme on New Year's Eve, and I said at the end, Jim, what are you doing tonight? And he said, well, the usual. I said, what's the usual? In bed by 10 o'clock,
He was a private person off air. I mean, on air, he was great. He was up front there, but he was quite a private person.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, I mean,
Very much.
I always remember this baker connection that he and I had, because he also did a baker's delivery. And as I say, I thought he said his father was a baker. I remember him saying on air, we both have the same family motto, we need the dough.
It also meant, Jeremy, if I could just quickly say, it also meant that he didn't trust people much. He was untrusting by
by
nature.
Might be quite good for an interviewer.
Yes, although, yes, but I think it's not good for a life.
Gosh, how interesting. Thank you. I didn't know any of that. Thank you very much, Andrew. I almost said Lord. Andrew Phillips, who Jimmy always called Lord, just to annoy you. The Legal Eagle and Dr. Mike Smith, doctor for 30 years. Great to see you.
Haven't heard your voice in quite a while. Feel like I'm back.
Van Morrison. Well, it's a sad day here at Radio 2. Goodness knows we've had a lot of them this year, not just with Sir Terry, but with Ed Stewart and other losses. Sir Jimmy Young was undoubtedly a great broadcaster. He basically founded this show, and I hope the values that he brought to it and created in it continue to this day. Andrew Lamb in Fraserburgh says, Jimmy was a big favourite of mine. I loved his interviews. He put everybody at ease. We've actually got an interview where he definitely didn't do that with John Major. And this is quite a famous one. This is just an excerpt from the 90s when John Major, as Conservative Prime Minister, was in trouble.
Let me ask you, in terms of leadership, people may have loved or hated Mrs. Thatcher, but everybody certainly took her seriously. And strong leaders can survive hatred and vitriol. But once people begin to laugh at you and make fun of you and draw silly cartoons of you with your shirt tucked in your underpants, is it almost impossible to regain your credibility?
I can't answer for the activities of the press. I can say that has been going on for...
That's John Major there. That was seen as a watershed interview. Maybe Jimmy will be most remembered for his interviews with politicians. As it said in the Radio Times, he talks to the people who make the news. Politicians queued up to come on his programme because they knew two things. They knew they could not only reach an audience that maybe didn't get its news from other sources, didn't listen to Radio 4, maybe even didn't watch the TV news, but also that the politicians wouldn't be rushed. They would be treated with great charm and courtesy. Jimmy always said that he used always first names with politicians, with only two exceptions, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, and I think the Leader of the Opposition as well. Politicians knew he was no pushover. And earlier I spoke to the former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, and asked him about the circumstances in which he first listened to Jimmy Young.
Well, I think Jimmy started in Radio 1 in 1967 after he'd come from Radio Luxembourg, and he was doing this morning show 10 to 12. I was actually in hospital not just in hospital, but I was blinded. I wasn't able to see at all, so I couldn't read, I couldn't listen, I couldn't watch television or watch films or anything, and I had to listen to the radio all the time. And I was in hospital for weeks in 1967, then 1968, then 1969, then 1971. I had a whole stream of operations. So Jimmy Young was a bit of a lifeline, and he was... in his early phase, which I think was light, it was optimistic. I remember all these words he had, you know, TTT through to 12, BFM, bye for now. There was a recipe thing, I think, what's the recipe today? There was all these familiar lines that I still remember nearly half a century on. And he, I think, lightened up people's lives generally, but for someone in hospital, blinded and not able to do anything else, it was very... good listening. And of course it was the start of Radio 1, and Jimmy Young at that time was of course not, I think, in his later phase, which was Current Affairs. He was really a DJ.
Could you sense that this was a person who wanted to do more than music?
Well, I think once I knew more about Jimmy Young's life, I mean, he came from a working class background. He worked his way up. He suffered huge disappointments himself. I think his singing career was really promising and then didn't take off in the way he'd hoped. I think at one stage he applied to the BBC and didn't get in. I think he knew what it was like to, for things to be tough, and so he valued what he had done and what he was achieving, and I think he was a better man for all that. I don't think there was anything precocious or pretentious about Jimmy Young at all. He was very down to earth. He was very friendly, of course. When I talked to him later, when I did interviews with him, I know he didn't agree with all my views, and he, of course, he wrote a column for the Daily Express in his later life, so he spent some time attacking me, but I could forgive him for all that, because he really did make a difference to my life early on, and I think he made a difference to many people's lives. I think he gave people a sense that life could be better, that you could be optimistic about the future, that there were things that you could agree on, and you could be part of a community. And I think he made his program on Radio 1 one where people felt part of that community. I read that he said he wanted to die with his headphones on, and he really was someone who spent half a century in radio. And while we miss him today, it's a sad day. I think he had a great life of achievement behind him.
One of the things about his show and his approach was that he believes that people should be able to have the time to answer questions, which went out of fashion a bit slightly.
Well, maybe that was your interviewing technique. I don't know, Jeremy.
Thank you.
I think he did give people time to answer questions. I think he said once, and I thought was very impressed by that, he said, even if I have a soft voice, it doesn't mean that the questions are soft. And I don't think, actually, when you were being interviewed by Jimmy, his questions ever were soft. I think he researched them pretty profoundly. And if I wasn't able to listen to his program much when I was running around the country, my memory more is these years from 67 to 71, when, as I say, I had a sequence of years where I was listening to the radio, and it was at the time that Radio 1 was probably at its zenith, as it came into being and took over from Radio Luxembourg in the generation that I was brought up in.
Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister, thank you very much. And I'm now joined by two politicians who knew Jimmy well, Labour MP Frank Field and the former Conservative Minister John Gummer, now Lord Deben. Frank, I know you always put yourself out to come on this programme.
I did indeed, and on one occasion, Patrick Jenkin, who was one of John's colleagues, said, "Why do you spend so much time on the Jimmy Young programme?" And I said, it's crucially important if you're not in work where trade unions try help to educate you, if you're not an employer, there's this great mass of people who are waiting to actually hear messages and maybe messages differently. And he told Mrs. T about this. And when I then next met Mrs. T, she quizzed me about it and wondered whether it was worth her while coming on. I said, worth your while coming on. I think it's more important than going to a summit. You should go on Jimmy Young programme. And as you know, she became as addicted, partly to Jimmy, as she knew that she was reaching to a market of people she needed to move if she was going to keep winning elections.
John Gummer, that's right, isn't it? She was on 14 times, I think.
Well, yes, that was true. But the great pleasure I found with Jimmy Young was not that he was easy to answer, because he wasn't, but because he asked you the questions that you knew people wanted the answer to. He didn't ask you the clever questions which clever people wanted. he asked you the questions that you knew that people out there wanted to know. And that's why the audience was such an important one to reach, not just because they were there, but because they saw in Jimmy Young a person who would ask what they would have asked if they had been there. And I found that engaging, very tough, very difficult, but it was always worthwhile.
Johnny, can I just add to that, that he had this wonderful technique, which was to allow you as much rope as you wanted, and if you wanted to hang yourself, he wouldn't actually save you. And it was always a reminder coming on about the dangers, that this was not a soft touch in any way.
Did you,
because
Frank...
The victims that morning were strung up around the studio.
Yeah, but the thing was that he didn't give you the time in order to hang yourself.
No, to explain.
He gave you the time to explain. And when people have time to explain, they very often don't get away with what they can get away with if it's just a short, simple three sentences.
Yeah, no, I'm listening to you both. Just thinking, there's a lesson here for this show, which is just try to never say, and please briefly tell us the problems with the economy, because you might as well not ask the question. There was a day, Frank, you came on, I think, and you'd just been exiled by Gordon Brown, hadn't you? And you gave the story to this show.
Well, it was Tony Blair, but as always behind the scene, there was the dark force of Gordon Brown, and I had to make a first public announcement on my resignation, and the programme that I wanted to come on to actually make that, partly because there was going to be nobody was going to be tripping me up, but actually genuinely would like me to explain, was the Jimmy Young programme, and I refused all other offers to go on other programmes so that I could come on here and explain why it was all hopeless, that Gordon quite rightly had a vision of shoving everybody on means tests. I had a vision about us moving to an earned basis for welfare, a national insurance base. There wasn't much point carrying on, but he was Chancellor, he was the senior figure. And though Brown was quite obviously winning, and Blair saying, "Oh, come on, take another job," I thought at that stage it was better to move out and try and find other work, so to speak.
Let me play just a little clip of this, again, this John Major interview, which was a very famous one, and this is when Jimmy was asking the Prime Minister if he planned on fighting the opposition over tax rates in the next general election.
Kenneth Clark said the other day, Tories fight elections on low taxes. He said, we did it last time and we should do it next time. So your critics will say, you've massively increased taxes now so you can cut them again in time for the next general election. I mean, even if that's only partly true, it's a pretty cavalier way to run the economy, one of the thought, and it certainly takes a cynical view of the electorate.
Neither is it true. It isn't true in any way.
Well, if you fought them on low taxes one, and you're going to fight them on low taxes at the next one, they certainly aren't low now.
We don't know whether we will be able to fight them on low taxes.
Oh, so you don't agree with what Kenneth Clark said?
What we do know is that...
No, really, you're disagreeing with Kenneth Clark?
I'm not, and if you let me finish, I'll explain why not.
Right.
What our position is and always has been is that we are a low-tax party by...
John Gummer, I'm remembering that was a big moment for the Jimmy Young show.
Yes, it certainly was. It was rather unusual for Jimmy to interrupt in that way.
Yeah, it was an unusual interview for him,
It was an unusual interview, and he got involved in it in a way which perhaps he didn't in other ones. I mean, ostensibly involved, clearly involved, whereas normally he'd done all his involvement beforehand, prepared what he wanted to say, and he kind of gave the impression over the airwaves that he was sitting back and enjoying the reaction of the person he was talking to. And that's what seems to me his essential strength was. Not just that he asked the questions people wanted answered, but also he asked them in a way which was polite, courteous, respectful even to politicians, and it made the politician actually treat him properly. That was a very unusual thing, because there are many other interviewers who manage to make the politician treat them wrongly, either be patronising to them or be too friendly. Somehow or other, you were neither of those things, even though you liked Jimmy Young a lot, thought him to be very competent, but you didn't get too close or move too far away.
But it's interesting if we're getting to a point, Frank, where we actually, having played that John Major interview, we realise it's actually the wrong example of Jimmy's interviewing style, because it was an exceptional moment, but that wasn't what he did day to day.
It wasn't, but I think he did play his other card that reminded people there was another side. There was steel, actually, in that velvet glove that could actually land on you, in that John was hoping that people would forget by the election that the taxes had gone up. And it's noticeable that it's only because John Major was not answering the question that actually Jimmy came back to remind people that if in X period time they went into the polls, they should actually remember that this party has actually put up taxes and now was actually going to fight on low taxes. But I think one of the most wonderful thing coming in this morning, Jeremy, is actually hearing that voice.
Yes, you're right.
Oh, it's so terrific, yeah, isn't it?
It is an amazing voice.
But he was handing out rope to John. And if he, you know, got slightly exasperated by putting the noose around John's neck, because he felt the noose should be round there.
Thank you very much for your memories. We really appreciate you coming in. Frank Field, Labour MP for Birkenhead, and John Gummer, former Conservative Party Chairman, former Environment Secretary. We'll talk a bit more about Sir Jimmy Young, who died yesterday, and maybe about the voice and the star quality after this. Dave is on the Corky emails, one great memory I'd love to hear again. Actually, we played a snatch of this earlier, is the interview with the then Transport Minister, John Prescott, who Jimmy kept referring to as two jags. It was very, very funny. Diana Hutchins said he's in Gloucester and says, Jimmy Young was an integral part of my teenage years. My mum got a radiogram in the 1950s, and his was the first record I bought for it. We'll play another record by him before the show is out. Latterly, says Diana, his show was so brilliant, he will always be in my heart. Frank Field, Labour MP, who had a very close relationship with the show, was just talking there about Jimmy's voice. And let's talk to a great critic of Radio Daily Telegraph's radio critic, Gillian Reynolds, who knows the industry so well. And Gillian, let's talk about the voice and the star quality of Jimmy, because that was a big part of it.
You mustn't forget, Jeremy, that in the olden days, when we were all listening to Jimmy Young for the first time, regional accents were pretty rare. I mean, great criticism of the BBC in wartime for Wilfred Pickles' Yorkshire accent, but Jimmy's Gloucestershire burr was an absolute delight. But you knew it, you know, you knew it. You could hear it in his singing voice. And I'm old enough to remember when he was a singer and when he was on Radio Luxembourg. And, that very warm voice. And that carried through, I think, to his studio style, because the great art, I think, looking at it from the outside, as it were, of radio interviewing is to make the listener feel as if they're there in the conversation. So you are not talking to me, you are talking to whoever's listening and me, and the three of us with the unseen person are in the same conversation. And he did that every time. It didn't matter who he was talking to or where he was talking from, whether it was Egypt or America or Russia or just at home at Broadcasting House. That was it. You know, we were all part of the same conversation. We were all together there.
And you did have a sense listening that the audience was present. The show almost hummed with the audience, didn't it?
Yes, and it was interesting because it wasn't a phone-in show. They took listeners' requests and thoughts and comments, and he would read them. And it wasn't that sort of brutal voice-on-voice wrestling contest that you get so much of nowadays. It was a considerate, you've sent us this thought. And, you know, every thought was given due credit and due time.
So he had a star quality, there's no question, but when you try to work out what it was or what it came from, as always, it's very, very difficult, isn't it?
Well, I think intimacy is one thing. Affability. He always seemed cheerful. He seemed like good company. And these were different times, you know, when he started off at the BBC. More women were at home. Fewer women worked. There was no media training for politicians. Things were different. And that quality of feeling connected to someone happy, it was the company you didn't have, you know. There was me. I listened to it every single day from when it started, and he would, you know, he would be with me as I was washing the dishes and throwing the nappies into the buckets and all that kind of thing. And it was that wonderful feeling of somebody being there with you, somebody who could cheer you up, you know, play a bit of music and you could groan and say, oh, I hate that record. And then he would go on and it would be fine. And it was feeling part of a national conversation. And the curious thing is, there weren't that many other voices there except the studio guests. But what guests? I mean, Andrew Phillips, now Lord Phillips, talking about the law. Mike Smith talking about medicine. I remember to this day some of the advice I got. I didn't save any of the recipes, though. Did your mum save any of the recipes?
I don't know, but the funny thing was that it got misreported when I started the show that I was dropping the recipe slot, and you know there hadn't been a recipe slot for 15 years, so
yeah.
It was not something that was going on in the 90s, that was it. It was more of a 70s 80s thing.
Oh, it phased out. It phased out. But still to this day, you know, I said the other day, my youngest son came around to lunch with all the babies, and I said, oh, I've made so-and-so. And he said, what's the recipe today, Jim?
Amazing. Thank you very much, Gillian Reynolds, Daily Telegraph radio critic. Yes, so there was a producer called Ray, and the line was, what's the recipe today, Raimondo, was it? And it was a kind of speeded up voice that was played, and then they would discuss a recipe. We should bring that back. Julie Dean emails, my abiding memory of dear Jimmy will be of him accompanying the birth of my first daughter, Maisie, 8th of May 1997. Doesn't feel that long ago, does it? It was when the Blair government started. As I was entering the second stage of Labour, Jimmy was talking about melons. Fond memories of our Jim. 0500 288 291. Let's read some now. Actually, look, let's take a caller. Let's break with tradition. Betty Williamson in Chingford. You listen to the show, firstly.
Oh, always. And the recipes particularly. And you're talking about Margaret Thatcher going, and she often used to bring in a recipe as well.
Oh, did she? Well, now I've heard a tape of her doing something with honey once, I remember. Yeah,
yeah,
you're right, now you mentioned
it. I remember the shepherd's pie.
Oh, yeah, so she gave
her a recipe for shepherd's pie.
That must have been a great listen.
Yes, and I have still got Jimmy Young cookbook, where the recipes of all from all the listeners.
And
there's some lovely recipes, I can tell you.
What's your favourite one, then?
I don't know. I can't remember now the ones, but, I mean, I've got some in here. Hot dog potatoes and barbecue sausages. It's all kinds. It's a lovely little recipe book, and it was 3 and 6p.
So you still got it?
Oh, I've got it in front of me now, Jeremy.
And do you have some lovely memories of listening to Jimmy?
Oh, I loved it. I really loved it, because when he was at home all day and I had 5 children, there was always something to do. And as the last listener said, it helped you through the day. It was marvellous.
And he did it for such a long time. 29 years on the one show is an amazing record, isn't it?
Yes, and I mean, like the others, you know, I had records of his. I don't think I've got those now. They might be up in the loft.
Oh, I'm going to play one. Do you like The Man from Laramie?
Yes.
Shall I play it?
My favourite is Too Young.
OK, we'll play that at the very end of the show. We'll play that for you.
Lovely.
OK, Betty.
Thank you so much.
You take care. And you take care. Simon in Leeds, and thank you for joining the new show as well as Jimmy's. I should register my appreciation there. Simon in Leeds has called. He says, as soon as you play Jimmy's theme music, it took me straight back to my childhood. Yeah, me too. His theme became known as the Fish Fingers music because that was what I had for my lunch. Comment of the day. Jeff Jensen emails, and Jeff says, working alone from home for 10 years, Jimmy was my radio friend every morning. I am sure Sir Jim is singing Ghost Riders in the Sky to Sir Terry just to carry on their banter. This is a sad day for me. Thank you, Sir Jim. There's some terrible losses at Radio 2 this year, that's for sure. Roger Booth emails, 23 years ago, while sat discussing my impending divorce with my solicitor, she commented that I was very well informed, to which I replied, I had Jimmy Young to thank for that. There's no higher praise. Keith in Maidstone says, I had the pleasure of meeting Jim
Jim in the early 90s as I was working as a contractor, installing a cable in the BBC car park. He always came over and said hello. He was a real gentleman and will be sadly missed.
The man from Laramie, he was a man with a peaceful turn of mind. He was kind of sociable and friendly. Friendly as any man could be. But you never bossed or double-crossed the man from Laramie.
Danger was this man's specialty. Leslie Cookman tweets, I remember all the words to Jimmy Young's hits. And Scarlet Magpie on Twitter says, my gran used to clean his flat in Chiswick and he was lovely to my gran who thought the world of him. My heart goes out to Alicia. By the way, tomorrow night, that's Wednesday at 11, there's another chance to hear a special programme recorded on the occasion of Jimmy's 90th birthday. He shared a lifetime of memories with Ken Bruce, so that's 11 o'clock tonight. Oh, sorry, tomorrow night here on Radio 2.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Well, that was one of my favourite items. Wasn't that brilliant, meeting Guy and his mum? And it, the mum advised to, look, if you want him to walk, you're going to have to not help him when he falls over. And so moving, isn't it? You imagine how difficult that is for Anne when she's a young mum and she's shopping with her son and he's falling over and she's not helping him get up and everyone's saying, what are you doing? And she says, I've got to let him do it himself. And now he's not just walking, he's a great entrepreneur. June Herbert in Worcester Park in Surrey calls about Jimmy Young. Let's return to the thoughts about Sir Jimmy, who died yesterday having presented this programme for 29 years. I'm standing in the kitchen preparing dinner for my grandchildren, and it's from a Jimmy Young cookbook. They won't eat much else. Raymond Macquarie in Barking says he was instrumental in me starting a mobile disco. I used to love listening to his shows. It's so sad he's passed away. John Acker in West Mersey said, I appeared on the show many times with JY. We had a number of jokes together. I was a union man in charge of the universities. Jimmy invited me on in the 70s to talk about the expansion of university. And he was a real gent with a lightness of touch. Some lovely, lovely tributes. James Hyde in Nottingham says, I listened to him for years. He was breathtaking. His interviewing was well ahead of his time. It's a sad world without Sir Jimmy Young. So maybe a moment just to think about Sir Jimmy and pay our own tribute to him now. Well, I love presenting this show, but I'm never in any doubt that I am just the lucky soul who inherited the Jimmy Young programme. And the luck was all of ours. How fortunate was radio in this country to employ a DJ, a former singer of ballads, who in the 70s was struck by the revolutionary thought, why shouldn't a programme mix records and interviews, bring together the music of Dolly Parton and the words of the Prime Minister? Why does it have to be one or the other? Often when I say something like, thank you, Chancellor, now here's Kate Bush, I think of the unique lunchtime experience that Sir Jimmy created here on Radio 2. And his greatness is partly in his longevity, no question. In television, you become famous with one show. On radio, it's 10,000. Jimmy did the 10,000. He became your friend, as familiar as the armchair in the corner of the living room, but with a few more sharp angles. Think of that devastating interview with John Major in the 90s. To me, it's simply incredible that Jimmy was still live on the air for 10 hours a week at the age of 82, the age my grandmother was at in a nursing home. It's sad that he didn't leave this station in the way he would have wanted to, but perhaps he never would have wanted to. This programme was his life. I often wonder if he ever caught a snatch of it in his retirement and thought, I started that. Yes, Jimmy, you were the one who told the audience they could share the stage with the politicians because they were just as important. Maybe, listening in retirement, he would have been pleased
and realised how much we owe him. But I suspect he was far too modest to have that thought.